Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I want to say before I actually start talking about the sermon, I'm not sure that you, the congregation, know what it means for me, the minister or preacher or person who stands up in front on Sunday, whatever you might choose to call me, means to see your faces out there. It means a great deal. And I think often it may go the other way around, but I want to let you know that has meaning to me and it is important to me. And I don't know where else to go with that except simply to say it. And thank you. We've been talking recently and the last months on comfort zones and fabric of the universe. And last week we talked about a tear, or as one person told me, a tear in the fabric of the universe. And we looked at Margaret Fuller, who in 1830 challenged the scientific view. Usually we Unitarian Universalists like to affirm the scientific view, but if we remember this part of our history, it'll help us be skeptical believers, I guess might be the term. The scientific view of that day was that women were inferior and had no place in the public sphere to do men's functions because they didn't have what it takes. And Margaret Fuller said, wait a minute, that science is based on a faulty education. And it is not true. And then she proved through identifying, by actually demonstrating that she could function as a man and writing literature and reviewing history without putting her name to it, that indeed what she was saying was true. She tore the fabric of the universe that people were believing at that particular time in history, and one might even say she became the mother of therapy, of modern therapy, in terms of she identified scripts that people play in society and that we conform to in society that indeed could be harmful to others and harmful to self. So that's kind of a summary of that sermon, that there are times when we need to tear the fabric of the universe. We need to interrupt oppression in the social constructs we live under. We need to know the reality of the tangerine in order to enjoy the tangerine, or we need to know the reality of what's in front of us conceptually in order to point a finger to it and say, wait a minute, what is that about anyway? Whether it's a tangerine or whether it's legislation. What I noticed in that story and what I like about that story is that when we take time to become aware of what the external world is and the reality of the external world, we become more real. The other implication is if we are not about that, do we become less real? And what might that mean? This sermon today is about maintaining the fabric of the universe. How do we maintain the fabric of the universe even when the fabric of the universe may be oppressive to us? And I chose two stories to help us understand that. And the first story begins with a man, a rabbi in the first century, Jesus, who had some power. He was a rabbi. He could walk into a place of worship, a temple, and he could speak. Not anybody can do that. But he could do that because of his training. And he had developed a following. And in his following, the people wanted his message to get out. And it was an unorthodox message. As a matter of fact, the values of his message were against the values of the social constructs of the Empire of Rome, and which consequently is why he got in trouble later on, because he was actually talking about a value system that wasn't the dominant value system. And in this story, he meets this person, this woman, and her story is that she's coming to the well in the middle of the day, in the heat of the sun, which the normal practice is for women as a group to go to the well in the morning. So we know something's up. This particular woman had five husbands. And as the story goes, and if I've heard this story talked about in sermons before, usually at this point some kind of judgment comes out or some kind of negative, something negative about this particular woman, which exemplifies why she needed to be saved. Right? And I take offense to that, having gone through a divorce myself. When somebody moves through divorce, as some of you may have in your own life, how much pain do we experience? How much sadness do we experience? What is it like to have your dreams and your hopes as you project the rest of your life as going well and living well and going to have those dreams die? This woman has had that experience five times. So when this woman's coming at the well in the middle of the day, my thought goes, this is a person who is suffering inside. And not only that, the implication is she feels a great deal of shame about who she is. Not only that, she's a Samaritan. She's half Jew, half pagan. She's a person who is discriminated against for who she is. Not for what she does, not for how she behaves, but who she is. She's discriminated against by the Jews. So here comes this rabbi, this person of power in the Jewish community who has a following, and he meets her at the well. And he says to her, "Draw me some water." And she says to him, "Who are you, a Jew, asking me to draw you water? Because you're not even supposed to talk to me. I'm supposed to be invisible to you. You're not even supposed to see me." At that moment in time, when she says, "Who are you to recognize me and to speak to me?" If that story would have stopped there, and as I read that story, she's pretty antagonistic. If that story was to stop there, she is maintaining the fabric of her universe. She is maintaining the fabric of a universe, of a social structure where oppression is normal, where racism is accepted, because she is saying, "Who are you to talk to me? Don't talk to me. What is going on here? This is strange." She's setting a boundary back up. On the other side of the planet, we have a story of Siddhartha, Buddha, as he became the enlightened one later, but before the enlightenment, he's sitting in a woods and he's meditating. And as the story goes, when Buddha meditates, there's a golden aura and there's just a beauty about it and a wonderful process that he's going. And if you were to witness of that, you would tell there's something really special about this man. Well, over here, there's this 11-year-old boy, Savasti, whose parents had died, and that some person who owned water buffaloes took pity upon him and gave him the job of attending to the water buffaloes so he could feed his three siblings, because he was the oldest. So at 11 years old, he gets the responsibility to feed his three siblings, and he was fortunate enough to get this job. And he sees, and the buffalo are watering and grazing, and he could let them go, and he decides to take a walk in the woods to take a break. And so he sees the Buddha meditating, and he sees the specialness, and as the story goes, it tells, and he recognizes something special about this man, the peacefulness about this man. And then the Buddha wakes up, and he's strolling around, and he doesn't notice Savasti just yet. And when he does, and he turns and he notices Savasti starts running toward him. His impulse is to run toward him. His natural inclination is to connect with this man who gives the sense of being kind. And then all of a sudden, Savasti stops, dead in his tracks, as we are told. And Siddhartha says to him, "Why did you stop?" And he says, I am an untouchable. I can't approach you. I can't talk to you. And in that society, they had five caste systems. Untouchable was the lowest, those who cleaned. They had merchants, and naturally had religious and military people, and then they had kings. And you fell into that class, and wherever you were born, you were in that class, and you believed that about yourself. That was the fabric of the universe. And when he stopped and said, I cannot come and communicate, I cannot be touched by you because I'm an untouchable, he maintains the fabric of the universe. He maintains his fabric of the universe. He believes that to be reality. The woman at the well believes that to be her reality. That she is unapproachable. And if you approach her, she has a feeling about it. What are you doing that for? What are you about? At this point, these two people met another particular type of human being who had already been involved in tearing the fabric of the universe of oppression, and they were greeted differently. But however, I want to stop in the middle of that story and understand who is Savasti, who is the woman at the well. The Native American in 1870 in Carson City. The black man in 1949 in Alabama. The Irish woman, getting off the ship from Ireland in 1900. When I was in high school, I was on the wrestling team, and I was talking to a friend, Lee Whippo, who was not on the wrestling team, and Lee had long hair, and somebody on the wrestling team, we were in the locker room, Lee and I were just chatting, and then, I won't tell his name because you might know him, Kenny came up to me and says, what are you doing talking to that long hair? You know, and I'm, what? So I guess we could say long hairs of the 1960s could fit into that category. So who else might fit in that category? Who today might fit in that category? Who are the minorities today that are being persecuted? To be a liberal is to be a traitor. Are we Savasti? Are we the woman at the well? There are some people that say that liberals in our Congress don't speak up out of fear of what the propaganda machine would do to them and it would cost them elections, so they don't speak. When we don't speak, are we like Savasti, running toward that which is good, expressing our impulse, moving in the direction we know that is right, we know that is good, and we stop ourselves and say, we better not say that. I need not participate in that. How are we to understand these stories of maintaining the fabric of the universe when I know that creating a tear in that universe will bring us pain? In the song today, we said, pain, our soul is like an arrow, and that's how we know the pain. It says, peace is like a river that flows through us, flows through our soul. My experience is, unless we deal with the pain of the arrow in our soul, we don't feel the peace like a river moving through our soul. But the pain is somehow first. Last week when we talked about Walter Brueggemann, the theologian, who talks about relinquishing and letting go and receiving, he said you cannot relinquish the old to receive the new without going through a grief process. And that's just the way it is. I'm trying to think today, how can we identify what Savasti knew to be true? He was an untouchable. That was reality for him. The woman at the well was discriminated against, and she wasn't as equal to this man that was talking to her. And these stories are distant, and they're safe. How do we bring them home so that they become dangerous to us? How can we bring these stories home that they become so dangerous to us that they begin a transformative process in us and move us toward freedom. How do we create an understanding of that? Who are we as Unitarian Universalists in society today? Who are we as individuals that participate in this community? And I'm going to suggest a way to look at that and to understand that by using a family systems model. One model that I've talked about before, it's been a while, so I'll briefly spend a few minutes on that. And it's a model that comes from the addictive community, their study, their understanding of who we are as human beings. And it's a model that talks about addicts, and it's a model that talks about partners of addicts and the children that come out of that system. And originally, this system comes from when, in the 60s, we would take the person who was addicted into a treatment center. They would be doing fine. We'd put them back in the house, and they would relapse. So the community would say, what's happening? So then we realized that addictions were part of a system, not something in isolation. Now, that's not something I want to hear if I'm not the one using, because that means I'm part of it. But then we also realized that the family system that was identified is bigger than addictive process. It's commonplace in our society, and we see it in these stories. The language and the labels they used on these people was the dependent, the one who was addicted, the codependent, and then the firstborn child was the hero, then the scapegoat, then the lost child, then the mascot. The firstborn hero child is the hero. The firstborn, the hero, is the one you hear the parents talking about at parties, somewhere else. You know, it is the one that does the great things. The secondborn, the scapegoat, that's the one the parents don't talk about. See, what happens is the scapegoat wants to receive the affirmation and the praise that the firstborn hero gets, but it's not available to the scapegoat. So the secondborn begins to do behaviors that will get attention brought upon themselves. And then we hear the terms negative strokes. We do negative things to get attention. Not that I would ever do negative things to get attention. The thirdborn, and I think this is what's pertinent to Unitarian Universalist, is the lost child. Thirdborn sees this chaotic mess of where this addictive process, not necessarily a substance, but addictive process where people aren't really themselves, where people don't know they're eating the tangerine, but yet they're eating. When people don't know that they're affirming a social way of life that's oppressive by calling themselves an untouchable. By coming to the well, and this woman doesn't know she's affirming a racist process by saying, what are you doing talking to me? Stay away from me. We just do it. We just do it. So this family's just doing life. And so here's this mother and here's these partners working with these children, praising the firstborn but not praising the secondborn. And it's a chaotic mess when that goes on. The thirdborn looks at that chaotic mess and says, no thank you. And moves away from that. Goes to their room. Reads a book, reads another book, does well in school, becomes quiet, say if they were an extrovert, start leaning toward being an introvert, they become lost, and then they get the frame, the lost child. Then the fourthborn, the mascot, that's, I don't want to say we saw two mascots earlier today, but the mascot is the one when there is a tension in the room that creates a joke. Makes people laugh. Breaks the tension. I almost thought we saw competition for chief mascot. And it's clearly you all do too. So that's the mascot. But I want to go back to the lost child. The lost child retreats out of fear of chaos and retribution. The lost child sees that and retreats. My concern for us today are, do Unitarian Universalists move to become the lost child in our society? when there is aggressiveness against a particular way of thinking and fingers pointed and names called to the point of treason, which Helen pointed out to me, if we're traitors, the punishment is death. Is that assault? Are we being aggressed upon? You know, what is that? And we know when we look at history, when a particular group of people are scapegoated, we know what happens. We don't have to go back far in history to understand what happens when a group of people are scapegoated. We don't have to go far back in history to understand that scapegoating a group of people serves a purpose. So you scapegoat a group of people so you can do what you want to do over here. That's not necessarily good for the whole of the people. Are we becoming our way of thinking, our values, our principles? Are we becoming the lost child? Is the social cohesion in our community as strong as it could be? Are we retreating and want things to happen that meet our needs, but we don't have a thought or a consideration for other communities like us, or a thought or consideration for what's going on in our larger community? Are we content to sit and to read and to isolate, knowing that we have a comfortable and an okay life? Because the life of the lost child is not necessarily a bad life. It's a life that avoids conflict. It's a life that doesn't engage. It creates a nice, comfortable spot and exists there. We protect our thinking. It's a life that when I have an impulse to do something, that when I have an impulse to engage, I might move toward it, then a voice comes in my head and stops me from doing it, like in the story of Savasti. It's a life that when somebody's going to invite me for a transformation process in which that Rabbi Jesus was doing to the woman at the well, as that conversation continued, she was transformed and healed, moved through the shame and moved through the judgment and recognized that she was not being judged. If I'm maintaining the fabric of the universe, am I denying myself an opportunity for healing and an opportunity for transformation by staying in my comfort zone? Yes, we are. If on Tuesday night a member offers a group to talk about social concerns and you think in your mind, yeah, I would really like to do that, but then you say in your mind, no, I'm not going to do that, what would I say? Or for some reason your impulse is, yes, I want to go participate in that, then you have something else going on in your mind that prevents you from doing something you know that you would enjoy. You are stopping yourself dead in your tracks, as Savasti did. You are saying, as the woman at the well did, what are you doing talking to me? And then we turn around and go back home. And we don't participate in the larger community. We participate in the larger addictive process that we can identify clearly: heroes, scapegoats, lost children, mascots. The question we need to ask ourselves is, am I willing to identify the arrow that's in my soul, to deal with the pain so I can feel the peace move through me like a river in order to participate in the larger community and bring a voice to my best self, to my truest self? That's where we are today. There is an effort to diminish our voice as a community, to make fun of, to poke fun at, to shame, to belittle, to the point where I can remember I had an office in a Baptist church and I wouldn't even put the political bumper sticker on my car because I would know the people would respond to that bumper sticker in a negative way. Fear. The diminishing of my voice. What do you do when a minister and a preacher ask you to step into the direction where you're going to feel emotional pain? Fire. Because that is part of our spiritual journey. To let go of our past. to let go of our fears, to relinquish the things that hold us, to relinquish the prison bars that we have put around ourselves, and to experience newness. But in that experience of newness, we need to understand that we will go through grief. And that's just part of it. That's just part of it. This church is not a lost child. This church does speak its voice. And I am grateful to be part of that. But there is always a danger to move in that direction in today's climate. So we will continue to talk about that and what that means so that does not happen to us. The woman at the well had a conversation with this rabbi. Somehow, in being known and telling her story, she celebrated life again. She had new dreams. She had new hopes. Savasti, the untouchable, talking to Siddhartha, became a disciple, left his class system, left his sense of being an untouchable, joined a community, was loved, was cared for, was considered an equal. We too can let go of those things that hold us back. We too, when we have an impulse that moves toward health, we too can honor that impulse and belong to a community that will honor that and help us move in that direction. These are good stories, but they're better stories when we bring them home into our hearts.